Thank you all for being here. It's a pleasure to see you all. As Carter noted, this particular meeting is co-sponsored by the Intellectual Property Law Interest Group of the American Society of International Law and the Committee on International Trade Law of the International Law Association. I happen to have served for about 21 years as the rapporteur of that committee, specifically working on areas relating to trade-related intellectual property. And some of you earlier this week attended our session on Wednesday, where we presented and discussed the parts of that report dealing with intellectual property matters a bit more broadly than we're going to discuss this afternoon. This panel is here to discuss an institutional development or potential institutional development with the potential to dramatically transform the way that international intellectual property law is made and applied, and with potentially very significant implications for public policy interests, not only what we'll be focusing on mainly today with respect to public health, but certainly other areas as well. And the implications of these developments may not be immediately apparent to those who don't follow the development and application of international IP law very closely, but hopefully by the end of this panel, we'll have a better feel for all that. I'm going to briefly introduce kind of a baseline substantive background to what we'll be talking about today, no more than about 5 minutes. Then I'll briefly introduce the panelists to you and then turn it over to them. So whether and how to protect the property of foreign investors or aliens, of course, is a topic with a very long arc under public international law. We're obviously not intending to deal with the entirety of that arc. Traditionally, the protection of investments and the regulation of trading interests were covered by separate agreements. Typically, though not exclusively, trade agreements tended to be among a substantially number, larger number of parties than the traditional investment agreement, although I note that there was an attempt to negotiate a multilateral investment agreement in the 1990s that came undone in the end. There has been a much more recent trend towards integrating trade and investment agreements, and the agreement that will be the focus of our attention and in today's panel, the North American Free Trade Agreement, or the NAFTA, was among the first of those to really be creating that type of integration. The NAFTA was, of course, signed in December of 1992 and entered into force in 1994. And while that does seem to, I'm sure many of you, as a kind of an ancient history, at the time this was a very lively topic of discourse in the United States, and in fact one of the core issues in the ultimate election of President Bill Clinton. So investment protection became a key element of the NAFTA, the rules embodied in Chapter 11. Chapter 11 set out both a substantive rule and provisions on investor-to-state arbitration of claims, which could be either take place under ICSID or UNCITRAL rules, and based, not surprisingly, on diversity of nationality between the parties. Chapter 11 does not, in fact, specifically refer to intellectual property expressly as a protected investment, but Article 1139G refers to intangible property acquired in the expectation or used for the purpose of economic benefit or other business purpose. So if you're going to bring intellectual property into the NAFTA, you'll bring it in under investment chapter, you'll bring it in under that provision. The standard of protection is set forth in Article 1105.1, each party shall accord to investments of investors of another party treatment in accordance with international law, including fair and equitable treatment and full protection and security. And arbitral tribunals under the NAFTA have consistently interpreted that as importing the customary international law standards of investor protection as the standards being referred to in Article 1105.1. And I would like to just briefly read a few sentences from what I think is the best done decision on what that standard is from a decision in Glamis Gold versus the United States. It happened that David Caron, a former president of this society, was one of the panelists, and Michael Young, and so forth. And to just state very briefly, quote, to violate the customary international law minimum standard of treatment codified in Article 1105 of the NAFTA, an act must be sufficiently egregious and shocking, a gross denial of justice, manifest arbitrariness, blatant unfairness, a complete lack of due process, evident discrimination, or a manifest lack of reasons, so as to fall below accepted international standards and constitute a breach of Article 1105.1. Such a breach may be exhibited by a gross denial of justice or manifest arbitrariness falling below acceptable international standards, or the creation by the state of objective expectations in order to induce investment and the subsequent repudiation of those expectations. So in the case we're going to focus on, though by no means exclusively, this is a claim brought by Eli Lilly, a U.S.-based pharmaceutical company, against the government of Canada under UNCITRAL rules. Eli Lilly is essentially claiming that by the judicial evolution of a standard of application of the so-called utility doctrine, and in particular a doctrine called the promise doctrine, and more specifically the doctrine of sound prediction, and this was a standard developed by the Canadian Supreme Court in 2002 in a case known as Apotex v. Wellcome, the doctrine of sound prediction, that the application of this doctrine, in particular in the invalidation of two Eli Lilly patents, one involving Strattera and one involving Zyprexa, constitutes an act of expropriation under the standards of customary international law. Now, Professor Reichman told me before that he will revert to the doctrine of sound prediction. I guess I don't want to bore you, but I will just state briefly it's a three-element test according to the Supreme Court of Canada. Let me briefly tell you those elements. You might have them in mind. That you either, in order to fill the promise, must have demonstrated utility at the time of application. And if you haven't demonstrated utility, then there has to be a factual basis for a sound prediction of utility. An articulate and sound line of reasoning at the time of the patent application from which the desired result can be inferred from the factual basis, and proper disclosure, normally a full, clear, and exact description of the nature of the invention and the manner in which it can be practiced. So the question is whether that statement or doctrine represents a violation of customary international law. Now, of course, this particular proceeding or claim is only the tip of an iceberg. That is, as I'm sure you all well know, the question of investor-state dispute settlement incorporated in trade and investment agreements is right now a very hot topic. It's a major bone of contention between the European Union and the United States in respect to the TTIP. It's also a major issue in the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations, and our panel will revert to that. But Certainly, I think at least Professor Reichman will go into a bit of detail about the doctrine of sound prediction and whether or not that is a violation of customary international law. So we've assembled a distinguished panel to address this subject matter for you. I'm going to be fairly brief on this. I'm not going to give you everything they've done in their distinguished careers. But I'll start. Our first speaker will be Susan K. Sell. She's a professor of political science and international affairs at the George Washington University Elliott School of International Affairs. She has a PhD in political science from UC Berkeley. More importantly, Susan is the author of undoubtedly the seminal work on the political economy of the Uruguay Round Trips negotiations and the aftermath of that in her book, Private Power, Public Law, The Globalization of Intellectual Property, published by Cambridge in 2003. She's recently contributed to a collection in a book called Emerging Markets in the World, Patent Order, that Carlos Correa, Peter Drahos, and I put together from Elgar. Susan is generally, I think, going to try to set the overall context for the discussion that we're having. The next speaker will be Professor Jerome Reichman, or Jerry Reichman, as he's probably known to you, the Byron S. Womble Professor of Law at Duke Law School. Jerry is one of the very first true IP scholars to address the potential implications of the TRIPS agreement on international intellectual property law and public interests more generally. He and I published in a refereed volume of the Vanderbilt Journal back in 1989 while the negotiations were still ongoing, and he continues to work very much in this area, although Jerry is a man of many hats and works in many areas of intellectual property. To me, he is really the father in U.S. law of the alternative liability rule for the enforcement of patent law that our Supreme Court eventually adopted in the eBay case without actually attributing it to Jerry. I suspect that's because their clerks weren't sufficiently grounded in IP law. Finally, Jamie Love, sitting to my right. He is the director of Knowledge Ecology International. He has a degree in a master's in public administration from Harvard Kennedy School and a master's in public affairs from Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. To my mind, there is no one individual has played a more important and prominent role in promoting the interests of the public in access to medicines and related healthcare technologies in general. Jamie was really in the vanguard, one of the very first people to get deeply involved in the issues of access to medicines, particularly in relation to the South Africa pandemic. Was very active in promoting the introduction of generics in South Africa back in the late 1990s when first-line treatments cost $12,000 in the OECD countries and were eventually reduced to $300 and now much less in South Africa. Jamie's prepared comprehensive guidelines regarding patent royalties for UNDP, which have been widely cited and, in fact, were relied on very heavily by the courts of India in the recent Nexavar case. Jamie had the concept that came to underlie the medicines patent pool, was really one of the first to reintroduce the idea of the importance of potential pooling of patents for access to medicines. And Jamie helped to conceptualize the R&D treaty, medical R&D treaty, which is currently under discussion at the World Health Organization and so forth. He is really, to a large extent, the Thomas Edison of global public health policy in the sense of his level of innovation in this area. And we can see that he also knows how to let his cell phone ring. Finally, after the three panelists, we're going to have a brief comment. He just walked out momentarily. Gary Horlick will make a comment, a sideways comment about the tobacco cases. Gary is one of the most prominent international trade lawyers in the world. long experience in the U.S. government, including both in Congress and the International Trade Administration, at the Commerce Department, and frequently represents governments in the WTO dispute settlement and just works on a number of WTO panels. And so Gary is going to make a comment at the end. I would just finally note in my too long introduction that we did extend invitations to the lead counsel for Eli Lilly in the NAFTA dispute in this case. She declined on grounds that she didn't want the case pre-assessed before it was arbitrated. We extended invitations to representatives from pharma, to several of the large originator companies, and none of them are here with us today. I can't exactly articulate the reason for that, but the fact of not having a representative from the originator industry here is not something that happened by our oversight. It was a declination of invitation. Hopefully that's a far too long-winded introduction, and I turn the panel over to Susan.
Hi. Thanks for coming. I first just want to apologize, but I'm going to have to leave early because this is my town and I teach at 2:20. Today we're going to talk about Rwanda and South Sudan. If you want to come on over, it's pretty depressing. So what I want to talk about today, I'm a political scientist. I'm not a law professor. And what I want to do is put this agreement or these kind of provisions in a broader political perspective. And for those of you who are fans of the show Game of Thrones, I feel like my scholarship is often just to tell everybody that winter is coming. So I think that these are dangerous provisions. I'll talk about why, but there's really quite a bit at stake here. So I'm going to make three points. One is talking about the interests of firms versus policymakers. Second will be about the kind of pressure that the pharmaceutical industry in particular has been putting on various countries who are trying to promote access to medicines. And third, I'm going to talk about investor-state dispute mechanisms as an instance of private ordering, which I think is really what's going on here, and I think it's quite dangerous. So those are my three basic topics. When I think about the interests of the firms and pharmaceutical firms, just because that's the example for today, I think of them as a waterfall, a very, you know, maybe Great Falls, rushing to the bottom and relentlessly rushing. And they have a very clear aim, and that is to return shareholder value. All they're interested in is profits because that's how our system works. So they have a very laser focus on what they want to get in return for their shareholders. So they have the very clear bottom line. Policymakers don't have that clear bottom line. They have to balance all sorts of different public policy interests against each other, health issues, the environment, energy. And if it's a democracy, you have to worry about being reelected as well. So the policy landscape is much more complicated for policymakers, and I understand the laser focus of pharma because that's how shareholder capitalism works. Now, the pharmaceutical industry was very instrumental in getting a TRIPS agreement, in getting this multilateral intellectual property agreement. And Jacques Gorlin, who headed up the International Intellectual Property Committee, that was one of the main private sector negotiator platforms, said that they were very happy with TRIPS. They got 95% of what they wanted for both copyright and patent interest. They had to make some compromises. And ever since TRIPS was adopted, pharmaceutical companies have relentlessly been going after that 5% that they didn't get and pushing in other kind of venues. They're pushing in terms of bilateral agreements, vertical forum shifting outside of the multilateral arena. They are always asking for what we call sometimes TRIPS plus, increasing types of protection like data exclusivity, and also TRIPS minus, getting rid of the flexibilities, you know, forbidding parallel importing, for example, which is completely compliant with TRIPS. You can parallel import. So they've been going after that 5% that they didn't get. So TRIPS was never enough for the pharmaceutical industry, and everything they've done since then is living proof of that. So my second point is that as a result of this, they have been exerting constant pressure, relentless pressure, you know, the waterfall going down. There's a boulder in the way, you know, maybe the Doha Declaration, access to medicines, but the water keeps rushing around and finding other ways to get to the bottom. So I'm going to give four examples of this kind of pressure. And the investor, the Eli Lilly is another case, but just to put in, this has been a constant thing. In the one case in the Philippines, pharmaceutical companies sued the equivalent of the Food and Drug Administration regulators in their personal capacity. And they don't make, you know, they don't have really deep pockets, but they were sued for doing something that was completely TRIPS compliant, but pharma didn't like it. A second case that's a country that's received a ton of pressure has been India. India, because they adopted, again, completely compliant with TRIPS, Article 3D of their Patent Act, which is designed to prevent the practice of evergreening. They don't want to extend the life of a patent when the active ingredient goes from being a tablet to a gel cap with no increased efficacy, for example. So they've been sued multiple times. There's extensive pressure. GW University Law School was part of the, they had an India project, which was also pushing on this area. Pharma does not like 3D. They like evergreening. That increases their bottom line. So they've been relentless, and to this day they're complaining about India to USTR constantly, even though Indian Supreme Court has ruled multiple times that it's okay for them to have 3D. A third case, of course, the very famous case, and there's an excellent documentary, if you've not yet seen it, called Fire in the Blood, and it's out now on Netflix. I'd recommend it. It tells a story of the suing of Nelson Mandela. And Jamie's in the film, as are some representatives of pharma, but it's an excellent documentary. It's won a bunch of awards. I'd recommend. But at any rate, you know, Bill Clinton, our first black president, sued Nelson Mandela, just reminding you of that. He looks pretty good in Fire in the Blood, but they neglected to mention that one detail. At any rate, so then he did regret it. He has publicly said that, and Clinton Foundation is doing a better job. But at any rate, sued South Africa, which was a huge public relations disaster. Now, just over the Christmas holidays, there are a bunch of leaked documents came out that pharma, South Africa now is talking again about reforming their patent laws to increase access to generic medicines. And these documents leaked out that pharma is backing an AstroTurf campaign, a fake grassroots campaign in South Africa to delay the South African passage of their health care law that would have patent implications to increase access to generic medicines. And in one of the emails, the guy said, ominously, South Africa's talking about public health again, which I thought was fascinating. At any rate, so the and a PR firm here in D.C. was putting this thing together. They were going to solicit academic papers that were vetted by pharma and to get sort of popular interest in the pharma point of view and delay the passage of this domestic law. A fourth case was, so South Africa, they're not leaving them alone even now. And then a fourth case was during the U.S.-Thai free trade agreement negotiations. There was a World Health Organization official named William Aldis, who was in Thailand. He was in the Bangkok office. And he wrote an op-ed in the local paper that said if the Thai government agreed to the terms proposed by the United States, it would bankrupt their 80-baht system, which is a healthcare system to keep costs contained. And some pharma representatives went to the then director of the World Health Organization and urged them to demote William Aldis, which they promptly did. And this made World Health Organization civil servants wonder, like, what about free speech? What about, you know, wasn't he supposed to look out for Thai health? I mean, that's why he's there. But he was demoted as a result of his making a case. And, in fact, the World Bank did a study after that and found that it would have cost the Thai government, like, $3 billion or something like that if they had agreed to these terms. So at any rate, this pressure has been relentless. And the final point I want to make is, those are just some illustrations, there's a ton, but I'm just giving you the flavor here. And this Eli Lilly case, I would argue, is another example of this. So the investor state dispute settlement process is what I would call an instance of private ordering. And private ordering is a way to, I mean, the effects of private ordering in this instance are policies that I would consider to be anti-consumer and certainly anti-generic drugs and trying to chill generic competition, which is the point of most of this pressure that they are exerting on these various countries who have access to medicines issues that are priorities for them. And this kind of private ordering is dangerous for democracy because these kind of agreements, this investor-state dispute mechanism, really circumvents sovereignty. It circumvents national sovereignty. And it puts policymakers in a position when who are they accountable to? Are they accountable to foreign firms? Or are they accountable to their electorate? Are they responsible for Eli Lilly's bottom line? Or are they responsible for looking after their population's public health, environment, energy? And should they have the ability to adopt rules that they think are appropriate for them if they are compliant with international law? All the examples I gave you before were compliant with international law, but pharma just doesn't like it. And so they find other ways to bully and to pressure. I think this is something that's happening much more broadly in intellectual property protection, including copyright. We're seeing much more private ordering. After the Stop Online Piracy Act and Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement Act went down in Europe, and then Protect Intellectual Property went down in just January 2012, we've seen a lot more private contracting between internet service providers and content providers that we're not privy to as consumers. They're not public. We certainly see a very, very dark cloak of secrecy over the USTR and the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. I think the only reason they don't want us to see the provisions is because they know we wouldn't go for them, because the Trans-Pacific Partnership Intellectual Property Chapter is asking for way more than TRIPS and way less than TRIPS in terms of flexibilities. It's a maximalist type of proposal, and one of my students did a network analysis of the leaked chapter that WikiLeaks leaked in November, and it shows how very, very isolated the United States is on intellectual property in particular, because that leaked chapter told the reader which countries were favoring which provisions, and U.S. was asking for the most extreme provisions, and it was very isolated. Japan was closer to the U.S. than any of the other countries based on this network analysis, but the U.S. is really asking for the sun, moon, and the stars, and probably a couple other galaxies as well for rights holders. And the non-transparency of USTR is a huge problem. It's a strange agency in that it's not subject to the same kind of public input or oversight requirements, and they only allow, you know, their cleared advisors, which happen to be rights holders, in on those conversations, even shutting Congress out, which is making Congress angry. So I think this is a very dangerous situation. Winter is coming if these things are allowed to go forward. It's going to really compromise policymakers' abilities to provide for all the complicated kind of public policy priorities that they have and circumvent sovereign democratic processes. And it's creating a huge democratic deficit. Another example of this private ordering is of course, the Snowden leaks and the NSA, National Security Agency. You know, that's anti-privacy. All sorts of and eBay voluntarily gave up our data to the government. So there's a lot going on that's I think we need to pull the curtain back on this if we're going to, you know, keep integrity for our democracy and for the complicated public policy that all of these leaders are trying to juggle. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Susan. Since Susan is going to have to leave a bit early before we get to the traditional Q&A, if anyone has a question they'd like to raise about what Susan just said or a comment or so forth, we'd be happy to take one or two comments right now. Yeah.
I just ask that given that
Could you say your name?
Sorry, Tom Kimbrough at SMU in Dallas. Given that the U.S. is isolated internationally on this IP protection issues you've mentioned, how is it that winter is coming and that these things are going to go through? Or why, if other countries don't agree, then why is that such a threat?
Because we don't stop, and they don't. These firms don't stop in trying to get what they want. They might win this case. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I can't judge. They might win this case. I know, you know, someone's going to be talking about the tobacco case. Australians are very worried about that. You know, and if you drive this, I mean, they're just not going to stop, and they're going to find ways to do it that are non-transparent. They bully developing countries, they say, oh, we'll invest in you. I mean, consider the irony that the 13 poorest countries in the whole world have the most stringent standards of intellectual property protection. Sub-Saharan Africa. I think they even have business method patents. So, you know, there are countries that are vulnerable. We use our market access, the carrots and stick investment or no investment, and we use it the government uses it effectively. And this has been a very bipartisan issue. Clinton was worse than George W. Bush. Obama's terrible. I mean, from my perspective, I definitely have clear opinions about this. I think it's dangerous for democracy. It's dangerous for consumers. It's dangerous for public health. So I just sometimes, you know, I'm using all the bad metaphors and stuff, but sometimes I feel like I'm Toto, and I just want to pull the curtain back on all this stuff because, you know, when they find out the wizard's some schlub from Kansas, but this is not good for us. They have a lot of power. They certainly, until we have campaign finance reform, they're going to have politicians in their pocket, which they do now. So that's partly why it's bipartisan. It has been the whole time. And it's very ironic, one more thing, very ironic, that Obama's pushing this foreign economic policy agenda when he wants his legacy to be affordable health care. It's fabulous, really unbelievable.
Okay, we're going to take one more question to Susan here. And if you could say your name, though.
We have it.
We have.
We've issued a bunch of them.
We have them. We issue them all the time.
That's all right. No, I thought maybe that was in conjunction with things that the federal government held or something like that, but not necessarily. But I'm just wondering, why is it that other countries' pharmaceutical industries don't? Why are we the bad guys?
Europe's doing it too. The European free trade agreements look like ours. And, and there's a number of Swiss companies, Novartis, has been very aggressive in this area too. So the Europeans are in the same space, and their free trade agreements are looking more and more like ours and being really super TRIPS plus.
So we're not the only ones. I mean, I guess speaking to that we're in isolation. I don't know.
We are in the TPP in terms of the extreme demands that we're making. And you can look at it. It's in the Monkey Cage blog that's published by the Washington Post, and it's an entry, just Google TPP, Monkey Cage, Washington Post, and you'll find this network analysis. It's really quite interesting.
And maybe Jerry Reichman can come back at the end of his talk and talk a little bit about the compulsory licensing situation in the United States, which is a trifle complex. I think you're correct that we don't have, in the classic sense, the express compulsory licensing statute, but we do have a variety of ways that we issue compulsory licenses outside the specific terms of the Patent Act. Maybe Jerry can answer that. Without further ado, I'll turn the microphone over to Jerry.
Well, thank you, Fred. Thanks for organizing this panel and for the privilege of being here today to talk about the compliance of Canada's utility doctrine with international minimum standards of patent protection. I have some slides that are here that I will refer to. In the interest of full disclosure, I was a consultant for Canada in the TRIPS case that the Canadian Supreme Court dismissed last year. Reading the notice of arbitration claim by Eli Lilly, so many specious claims of international law are raised here that it would take all afternoon, not 15 minutes. So I'm going to focus on what I think is the most relevant. Now, if we think generally, patents on chemicals, pharmaceuticals, biotech, especially gene sequences, and computer programs all raise similar issues about what functional effects are actually being claimed, described, and substantiated at the time of filing for patents. Why? Well, groundbreaking inventions are relatively rare in these subject matter areas. So would-be patentees are tempted to overpromise on utility in order to avoid challenges sounding in obviousness. They say we'll do a lot. The common policy underlying all these cases is that patentees should not be allowed to claim subject matter that goes beyond known or soundly predicted results on the date of filing. Now, lately, this problem has arisen in some pharmaceutical patents, a number of pharmaceutical patents. Why? Largely because, as you heard, the pharmaceutical companies try to evergreen prior patents by claiming that a small selection of a number of previously patented compounds provides some substantial advantage that merits new patent protection. The promise of the patent doctrine that arose in Canada seeks to ensure that firms do not obtain a legal monopoly on the basis of speculative claims about increased utility, especially speculative claims about therapeutic efficacy that were not substantiated at the time of filing. Now, different countries address this same problem under different legal rubrics, and a very fine article by Richard Gold and Michael Short. Richard Gold is a very famous law professor at McGill. This is panel two. This article is coming out. Gold and Short have shown that different countries approach the same problem in different ways. Canada's courts look for the promise of therapeutic efficacy in the patent application, explicit or implicit, and the extent to which the claimed effect has been substantiated at the time of application. Now, the plaintiffs claim that Canada's promise doctrine of utility is some new ad hoc idiosyncratic creation of its courts, and that no other country applies such an approach. Gold and Short demonstrate instead, first, the promise of the patent has a long history in Canadian and pre-1977 British patent law. Second, similar tests are used in other Commonwealth countries today, and notably Australia and New Zealand. Gold and Short also show that the U.S. applies a parallel approach by combining the doctrine of utility with the test of enablement. But then it gets interesting, because on the one hand, the U.S. authorities are more tolerant of Me Too drugs on the whole. Yet, in certain other respects, the utility doctrine of specific and substantial utility adopted in 2005, starting in 1995, can invalidate more biotech patents than Canada, because Canada does not impose a substantial utility test. So looking ahead, you have to ask yourself, hold it, if Canada's old promise of the patent test violates international law adopted in the 90s, how could the U.S. have tightened its utility patent doctrine in 95 and 2005? Gold and Short also show that the European Patent Office follows a parallel approach. What does it do? It combines its peculiar definition of invention as the solving of a technical problem with the EPO's own test of industrial applicability. In the end, the EPO applicant must show that it has achieved a technical effect or solution that amounts to an industrial application. That is, the product must demonstrate actual therapeutic efficacy beyond that of existing drugs to merit a legal monopoly. Now, if, as Gold and Short demonstrate, Canada's promise of the patent doctrine is neither new or idiosyncratic, as the plaintiffs allege, then we must ask, how could it possibly violate international laws applicable to patented inventions, particularly the TRIPS Agreement of 1994 and its regional twin and precursor known as NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement? The plaintiff's most central claim is that Canada's approach violates the standard of utility set out in Article 27.1, which you have on page 2 here, slide 4, and you have four words on this topic. First of all, it doesn't use the word utility, Article 727. It says patent inventions have to be new, involve an inventive step, and are capable of industrial application. So the first thing is that it doesn't say utility. It adopts industrial application. And in the footnote, a TRIPS agreement states the term capable of industrial application may be deemed by a member to be synonymous with the term useful. But the text does not claim that they are the same, and research shows that they are, in fact, different. States must use one or the other approach, but they are not the same. More importantly, neither TRIPS nor any other international agreement attempts to establish the substantive content of industrial applicability or utility, or for that matter, novelty or non-obviousness. Why not? Because there's no consensus on how to apply these doctrines. State practices differ all over the place. So what we have here for the first time in international law, a huge achievement, we have open-ended standards. We do not have rules. The contents evolve over time. For example, we just saw that the United States in 2005 changed its utility criterion to specific and substantial utility to address overly broad claims in biotech patents. Similarly, the United States Supreme Court has repeatedly elevated the non-obviousness standard since 1995. It recently disqualified patents on some forms of isolated or purified DNA as patentable subject matter, and it is maybe going to invalidate some business method patents on grounds of novelty or subject matter. All these and other approaches are valid precisely because there is no consensus on how to apply the novelty, non-obvious utility standards of Article 27.1. To limit state flexibility under this article, we would need to negotiate and adopt uniform standards under the substantive patent law treaty at WIPO, which Rochelle Dreyfus and I ferociously criticized in 2007 in an article on slide 5, precisely because there's no standards and we don't know the answers of how to do it. And precisely because there's no consensus and we don't know how to go higher, these negotiations broke down in 2007 and are going nowhere. In the absence of a consensus on the SPLT, there is no uniform or implicit standard of utility other than TRIPS, other than the duty to implement treaty obligations in good faith under the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaty. There are a lot of different state practices which continue to evolve. These practices are covered by the express language of Article 1.1 of TRIPS, one of the most important provisions in the whole treaty. If you look at slide 6, the last sentence, members shall be free to determine the appropriate method of implementing the provisions of this agreement within their own legal system and practice. And the WTO appellate body has chastised the panel for deviating from these norms. Why? Because if you look at the understanding on the settlement of disputes, which is there, yes, in slide 7, article 19.2, the appellate body pointed out that legal provisions, legal findings of panels and appellate body cannot add to or diminish the rights and obligations provided for in the covered agreement. Why? Well, because we have come to a trade context. When you move IP into the trade context, there can be no unbargained for trade concessions. You get quid pro quo. The appellate body has said there can only be explicit obligations set out within the text of the TRIPS agreement, and that, of course, is exactly what Article 7 on objectives and principles say. Article 8 gives the power of states to adapt the agreements to their public health needs, and then you get the famous TRIPS Declaration on TRIPS and Public Health in paragraph 4, which I think is its slide 4, which talks about the ministers reemphasize the flexibilities in TRIPS for public health in order to provide access to medicine for all. These provisions show that TRIPS does not impose uniform law in any manner or shape. It poses barely harmonized international minimum standards of protection that, in the absence of any agreed statements or official acts, WTO members continue to apply differently in their respective efforts to do what? Adapt 19th century patent law to 21st century innovations. Nor does the application of Canada's utility doctrine discriminate against pharmaceuticals under 27.1. As Gold and Short show, that doctrine has always been applied to different subject matters in Canada and other countries for a long period of time. Besides, the non-discrimination doctrine does not prevent reasonable differentiation when applying patent eligibility standards to different subject matters. On this issue, you might be interested in the forthcoming declaration of the Max Planck Institute of Munich on intellectual property on principles of international patent protection. In slide 12, Article 27 does not prevent states from reasonably differentiating between fields of technology according to the characteristics inherent in the technology at issue and the state's public policies pertaining to this sector. Now, against this background, we are asked to believe that the investment protection provisions of NAFTA, drafted in the mid-1990s, somehow overruled or froze the intellectual property provisions otherwise embodied in TRIPS and NAFTA. This claim is preposterous on its face because it would mean, among other things, that every decision by the United Supreme Court in the intervening 20 years that changed the application of U.S. eligibility standards is potentially ultra vires, because those whose patents were retroactively invalidated somehow have claims under the investment provisions of NAFTA. On what possible authority could the negotiators have agreed to freeze U.S. or Canadian intellectual property laws when the IP provisions of these very treaties proclaim a totally different message, a message of reserved powers of sovereignty over these issues on which the U.S. government relies all the time? Historically, investment protection laws bear on the conditions surrounding potential loss of specific investments by specific foreign investors in a host country. These laws may modify the general principles of public international law, customary international law, as applied to the expropriation of aliens' property as a quid pro quo for inducing particular aliens to invest in particular projects within the foreign host country. They may make an agreement with the government. We will invest $5 million or $5 billion to build a factory, but we want guarantees that you will not expropriate us except under the following conditions. Eli Lilly has made no specific investments in Canada pertaining to the drugs in question, nor has it negotiated any specific investment deals bearing on the facts of these cases. The only test of the patent standards applied by Canada or the United States under international law is whether or not they conform to TRIPS and the related international minimum standards embodied in the same IP provisions in NAFTA. There is no blatant or arbitrary acts of expropriation here. To claim that investment provisions in NAFTA froze the international patent standards of TRIPS is to say that all the evolution of patent laws in the United States, Canada, and elsewhere around the world since the 1990s that have tightened patent eligibility standards to obtain better quality patents is somehow illegal under the investment treaties. That is paramount to saying that the investment provisions of NAFTA were devised primarily to benefit patent trolls when legislation against patent trolls is pending in our own Congress at the moment. Any attempt to freeze the intellectual property standards retroactively by some doctrine of estoppel under these investment provisions would, in my view, constitute an abuse of the investment provisions themselves that will not withstand judicial scrutiny. The hard truth is what Susan Sell told you. The big pharma cannot swallow the fact that U.S. patent law did not become global law under TRIPS, and that U.S. cannot prescribe universal patent standards for the rest of the world any more than France could have prescribed uniform law in 1883 when the Paris Convention was first negotiated. Since TRIPS in 1994, there is, for the first time, a major achievement, a barely harmonized, important set of international minimum standards of eligibility. However, there is no duty to harmonize, and I say, despite scandalous testimony by two leading judges, one U.S. and one American at the Canadian Supreme Court, saying that there was a duty to that these provisions violated the duty to harmonize under TRIPS. You've seen the provisions. Look at the provisions. If you can find a duty to harmonize, let me know. There is no duty to harmonize. There is inbuilt flexibility to implement standards in each WTO member's domestic laws so as to advance the state's own technological and economic development needs. That's exactly what the Doha Ministerial Declaration on TRIPS and Public Health tells you. As a result, the developing countries, especially the BRICS countries, India and Brazil, having increased their own technological capacities, are now using these very flexibilities built into TRIPS to promote their own technological process and economic development. In their eyes, the patenting of me-too drugs and drugs based on merely incremental innovation rather than new and non-obvious chemical entities is not in the interest of their public health systems. I stop there. Thank you for attention.
Thank you very much, Jerry. And we will open Jerry up to questioning after the next speaker. I would just like to make one brief point. I don't know that there's anybody in American patent law as much relied on by organizations like the National Academy of Sciences and NIH and so forth for helping with the development and interpretation of patent law in the United States, including in the pharmaceutical arena. Juries' opinions are really in many ways a gold standard in U.S. patent law, and you know, very mainstream perspectives, I think, on how this system operates. Of course, you can have a quarrel with two lawyers about almost anything, but I would say that this is kind of, in my view at least, a very mainstream view of patent law and how it operates. And with that, I turn the podium over to Jamie.
For some non-mainstream views? No, I'm just kidding.
Okay.
thank you very much. I'll start by mentioning the obvious, which is I'm not a lawyer, so I'm going to talk about legal issues, but and I'm going to do my best on this. I think for many of us, we used to think of trade agreements as agreements between two governments or multiple governments that would set out, in the area of intellectual property, would set out norms for what a government could and couldn't do. And often when you look at those agreements, there's some parts which are really clear, like government has to grant a patent of 20 years, for example. And then there are other areas that seem not so clear, like, for example, the government has to provide reasonable or adequate compensation if they grant a compulsory license, or the government has to grant patents in different areas. Some of the language sort of seems clear. Some of it seems a little less clear. And we think of the process forward as governments litigating against each other. So in the Canada dispute with the European Union on what kind of exceptions you could give to patent rights, in 2000, there was a case in the WTO. There was lots of governments that had exceptions in their own law, filed very nuanced positions, and then there was a decision that came out of that that case, which is, you know, I think it's the main decision right now in that particular area. The sort of next step, the idea that it would be something like a TRIPS agreement, would be that there would be, you'd have NAFTA, you'd have TRIPS, you'd have the U.S. agreement with Chile, the U.S. agreement with Australia, the U.S. agreement now with, you know, the TPP negotiations. You'd have, like, a growing complex system of, like, different kinds of laws that are kind of put out there, which are not exactly the same. And then that was kind of confusing to people because there seemed to be, like, a little bit different wording in all these different provisions that were coming out. Now, there's, I think, a growing recognition that the investor state provisions are coming to intellectual property rights as an important way of defining what these differences in the language and the things mean. Now, it's an asymmetric system. If you think of governments to governments, you can assume that the government represents everybody within a country, and that's a reasonable place to start. But when you talk about the investor state dispute resolution, I think you have to admit that it puts consumers and business and right owners in a very different footing. We do not have the right in an investor state world to question the interpretation of a government to grant a patent or not grant a patent under the investor state provision. Pfizer does. We don't. That's basically the way it's set up. And as the Lilly case is demonstrating, I mean, it creates an area where a government, if they take a position in an area of controversy against Lilly, they're in a situation where Lilly can threaten them, in this case, with $500 million fine for taking a position in Canada that they don't like. If they had ruled the other way, in a way that Lilly wanted them to rule, there was, I think, no remedy really for the people that affected adversely by it in the other way. So it's asymmetric in that way. There are also, one of the things that in U.S. law, I remember I was asking I was asking Dick Wilder once when he was working for WIPO. I was asking him some question about how you would interpret some provision in U.S. law. And I was pointing to this provision in the statute, and I was quite worked up about it. And he said, given what you've shown me, he said, I would agree, you're right, he said, but what I don't know is what I don't know. It sounded a little bit like Donald Rumsfeld, but what he was referring to was that in the U.S. law, there's specific provisions, and then somewhere else in some completely other chapter of the law, there may be some other provision which basically, you know, says something different, which overrides that in some way. And so you know, you have to know quite a bit to understand what the law actually is in an area. What happens in the investor-state agreements, if you look at the 2012 model bid agreement by the United States government, which is apparently the text that's being presented in the U.S. negotiation with the European Union, they have very general sweeping provisions that go across entire classes, everything. I mean, in fact, basically, the basic rule is they come up with norms that apply to everything unless there's a special exception to them. So everything's in unless it's kind of worked out in a very narrow way. So intellectual property in NAFTA and in the model bid and in the EU proposal on the investments chapter, there's provisions of intellectual property which are kind of protected under investment agreements, but certainly not everything. And there may be something quite narrow that's kind of protected. In the intellectual property, just to give you an example of how things work in different, there's a question about compulsory licenses in the U.S. law. There are some specialized technical compulsory licensing provisions. For example, in the Affordable Care Act, if you do not disclose your patents on a timely basis to a biosimilar company developing a biologic drug, you cannot get an injunction at a later point against the infringement of that patent. That remedy is no longer available to you. But you can get, in some cases, a reasonable royalty. Some people would refer to that as a compulsory license. But interestingly enough, it's a compulsory license which is a limitation on a remedy to a right. In the WTO TRIPS agreement, this is kind of a technical thing, Article 31 of the TRIPS is a provision that most people associate with compulsory licensing in the WTO TRIPS agreement. It's a kind of compulsory license where a government proactively gives an authorization to use a patent, and there's certain rules that you have to follow on the export of products, on compensation, on prior notification, things like that. Separately, you can issue effectively a compulsory license under a three-step test under Article 30 of the TRIPS. But that would be a different part of the TRIPS agreement. In some of the exceptions that are written into some of the investment agreements, they would recognize the Article 31 mechanism, but not the Article 30 mechanism, which is a separate, more flexible in some ways and less flexible in other ways, but still it's an additional flexibility in the international framework. There's yet another way, which has now become the most common way to grant compulsory license in the United States, and that is a limitation on remedies. I mentioned the Affordable Care Act. Other examples would be 28 U.S.C. 1498, which is the authority under which the U.S. government has the right to use patents without the permission of the right owners, and which is used extensively by the Department of Defense and to a lesser extent with other federal agencies, but it's used often. That is not a grant of a compulsory license under Article 31 so much it is as a limitation on remedy under Article 44 of the TRIPS. It's a reduction in remedies to compensation of a particular kind. And within that particular issue, there's case law. And some of the case law, for example, says that to grant a compulsory license as a limitation of remedy under 28 U.S.C. 1498, It's not what the government gains, but it's what the right owner loses. There's a string of cases that say that. But if you look at the expropriation language, or if you look at some of the other language that people may argue about in some of the bilateral investment agreements, some of the language in some of the agreements makes reference to things like the full commercial value, or I mean, they sort of imply there's a different standard that would be used to judge what the compensation is than what's involved in case law under our own system of what was initially designed, initially in the U.S., as a limitation on our sovereign immunity against intellectual property claims. Then there's the eBay cases. These are the cases where the most growing area of compulsory license in the United States. Those are the ones where Samsung's trying to get a compulsory license from Apple. You had Apple appealing to USDR to not enforce an injunction from Samsung at the junction, at the border, and overturn an injunction by the ITC. You have Microsoft getting compulsory licenses from judges on software patents, Toyota getting compulsory licenses from companies on patents on automatic transmissions. You have Abbott receiving a compulsory license on a diagnostic for hepatitis C diagnostic. You have Johnson & Johnson getting multiple compulsory licenses, et cetera. And there's a whole string of those cases where a judge determines that the grant of an injunction is inequitable or against the public interest. Or in the case of the Apple case, where Michael Froman intervened, it was contrary to the interest of consumers. And in those cases, the government sets up some kind of compulsory license. Now the question is, are all of these decisions now, or some set of these decisions, in some way litigatable under these investor state provisions? Now, if you look at the initial group of investor state provisions, almost all of the initial bilateral trade investment agreements were done with really, really, the State Department has a list of them, of the country, and you might read them and you might say, oh, well, okay, that's, Mongolia or, East Timor. You have a lot of countries that seem like, maybe you don't think much of the legal system or something like that. So maybe the government should intervene and replace the market as the guarantor of the investment in some ways through that kind of thing. Fine. Okay. Now the new versions, I mean, certainly not that new because NAFTA is not new, but when the TPP, the idea of introducing it with Japan and Australia, and then bringing investor, then with the EU, with the 30 members of the European Union, it's sort of ramping things up. So the idea that somebody could sue the United States on the claim and test these things out, and this sort of expanding flexibility about what constitutes standing to sue the United States under these agreements, sort of it's leading to an area, and you're beginning to see an explosion of cases, and people, they're no longer thinking of these cases as about copper mines or oil fields. Now they're beginning to think about patents, copyrights, and trademarks, like the Lilly case, which was very timely for everyone involved in negotiations. It's kind of frightening because you don't all of a sudden, forget about worrying about Judge Rader. All of a sudden, you're worried about people you've never even heard of before, that may consult with companies, and it's some secret proceeding, and there's no appeal right. You can't even, attend the proceeding, necessarily, or read the pleading sometimes. So, I mean, it's kind of this sort of, creation of these corporate sovereignty kangaroo courts that are being created, negotiated in secret. You can't even look at the proposed text until it's all done, it was a fine last year of over $900 million in one of these proceedings involving a much smaller country. So, I mean, the fines can be big. And this is sort of the brave new world we're sort of supposed to sort of be looking at. Now, I just want to give you one example because am I running out of time here? All right, okay. Well, let's take hepatitis C. There's a new drug that Gilead's come up with, Sovaldi. It's a 400-milligram pill priced at $1,000 per pill. You have to take it 84 times in a 12-week treatment regime. It's a very good treatment. It's apparently, for 90% of the patients, a cure for hepatitis C. That's $2,500 per gram. The discounted price in Egypt is $1,000 instead of $84,000, but that's still really expensive for Egypt. You'll probably produce this drug at about 20 cents a gram or about $10 a treatment if you wanted to buy it at the same price as you're able to buy other Gilead products that we're currently buying FDA-approved versions under the PEPFAR program. So you got like a $10 product that you're paying $84,000 for in the United States. Now, Gilly has a good argument. They say that it's a cure, unlike an AIDS treatment, which may cost $25,000 and you have to take the rest of your life. It's a good drug. But here's the problem. There's 3.2 million chronic Hep C patients in the United States. That would cost $268 billion to buy the drug for all those people at that price. So what is the likely outcome of 84,000 with 3.2 million people? It's to treat 15,000 people who are acute patients and not the 3.2. But it's an infectious disease. So it means that your chance to eradicate the disease, you're just not even going to consider that. And you're going to miss a lot of people whose treatment would prevent them from having very expensive kidney problems and things like that that result in other kinds of medical cares. The problem's a worldwide problem. Apparently some people say there's 170 million people worldwide, or about 2% of the world population, is Hep C positive. So we proposed recently in a couple of meetings, we said this is an example where there should be a government buyout. The government should basically take the patent away from Gilead because it's too important of a medical invention to be put in a situation where it's only available to a tiny number of the people that benefit. And that Gilead should be compensated in some multi-billion dollar way, but maybe short of the gross national product of some countries. I mean, it'd have to be, you know, there'd be some argument about it. Well, how would that play out in the context of investor state provision? I mean, you'd have to ask yourself, to what extent would these ideas be that, like, for example, in the U.S., you could potentially say, well, since you're only applying it to a small number of people, we can compensate you for the market you're losing because of, in terms of people willing to pay the $84,000, but we're not going to give you $84,000 for every one of the 3 million people or whatever, or 1 million or whatever, however we can scale that up would be. But to the extent that you take whatever extremely difficult and challenging political debate is to get things right on that Hep C drug, which is an extraordinary opportunity for that, from the health point of view, to act now, and very expensive if you do not act now. Well, if you add on top of that the investor state uncertainties about how that thing would play out country by country, which is how a patent buyout would have to play out, you can see why people, among the reasons people are very uncomfortable with these things. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Jamie. And now I'd like to ask Gary Horlick, who I invited to give a brief comment. We had invited William New, the editor-in-chief of Intellectual Property Watch. Unfortunately, he was unable to attend today. So, Gary, could you please? Come on up here.
Thanks very much. I'm honored to be with such a legendary bunch of people in this field. So I will limit myself more to a factual description of where things are, bearing in mind, and I disclose, I'm counsel to Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, which, as you may guess, is opposed to tobacco companies blocking tobacco control measures. The background to this is that in about 8 years ago, 177 countries signed a World Health Organization Framework Convention on Tobacco Controls. And without getting into all the details, it's sort of a mass movement of countries to increase the amount of control on tobacco sales, particularly aimed at children. So there are all sorts of measures. It's a menu. You don't have to do all of them. You don't have to do all of them at once. But those countries, including the United States, which signed but hasn't ratified, not the only treaty we haven't ratified, I might add, are now rolling out those measures. The U.S. passed legislation in 2009, for example, giving the FDA authority to regulate tobacco for the first time. So as those measures are being rolled out in lots of countries, tobacco companies are suing in those countries to try and stop the regulations. And so far, they've been pretty much in every country unsuccessful. This has been to the Supreme Court in Australia, in Norway. It's been to the European Court of Justice, or whatever it's called now, it's headed, for, I think, for Ireland. So those have been unsuccessful because Supreme Courts tend to say, well, the government can do it because of public health. And I'm obviously giving you a very broad description of lengthy opinions. Facing that, tobacco companies in 2010, 11, decided to use international trade agreements to try and block tobacco control measures. And as I said, this is not an isolated thing. They're looking at every country in the world, more or less, starting to implement measures that they don't like. So, so the litigation has taken two forms. A case was filed by Ukraine in 2012 against the WTO against Australia's plain packaging measures, and I'll describe those in a second. That case has taken a while. There's still no panel actually composed, meaning people, three living bodies on the panel. People did, eyebrows were raised since Ukraine hadn't exported any tobacco products to Australia for some years. And Ukraine has some of the toughest anti-smoking regulations in Europe. And indeed, when the WTO case was filed, a Ministry of Health official publicly denounced it, which is unusual. The other branch has been, there had been subsequently, four other countries have started the process of WTO litigation on more or less the same grounds. Honduras, Dominican Republic, Cuba, and now Indonesia, all four of which at least produce tobacco. And there are different law firms involved, so there's some odd goings on. Apparently, one of the law firm for one of the countries doesn't want to be classed with the Ukraine case because they figure the Ukraine case is a loser because everyone suspects that money changed hands to get Ukraine to bring the case. So people think panelists won't like that. But no one knows. I'm speculating. Suffice it to say, the cases have not moved very fast in the WTO, which is, and I now switch into interpretation because I don't know this. The WTO litigation system is set up on the assumption that the plaintiff wants to win and wants to win fast. The classic WTO case, Jerry imposes a tariff on my rutabaga, I want him to stop. I want him to stop now. Particularly since the flaw in the system is there's no retroactive damages, so I really want him to stop now. These cases have gone nowhere, which leads to some suspicion that, well, maybe the tobacco companies aren't that interested in winning, but more in delay. Which I will come back to. The investment cases. There have been two cases filed under bilateral investment treaties, one by Philip Morris of Switzerland under a Switzerland-Uruguay bilateral investment treaty. That's been through the jurisdictional phase, which was a year ago, not quite a year ago, and is into the merits. Philip Morris had sales, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, Philip Morris Hong Kong brought a case against Australia based on the Hong Kong-Australia bilateral investment treaty. Little more complicated because Philip Morris Hong Kong didn't own any shares in anything relevant. So after the regulations were, I believe, proposed, but possibly were into effect, shares were transferred from Philip Morris Australia, I forget the name of the entity, to Philip Morris Hong Kong in order to get standing. So there's a jurisdictional dispute about that. There are all kinds of ironies here. Obviously, Philip Morris went shopping for the most favorable treaty against Australia, and the Hong Kong treaty was Australia, after the handover to China, reversion, was worried about possible expropriation of Australian assets, so wrote a very pro-investor treaty. There were a lot of bilateral investment treaties done in the 1990s where countries are having buyer's remorse, and the tobacco cases are increasing that. The core of the cases, all of the cases revolve, and they have many different charges. The core claim is that the TRIPS agreement in WTO creates a right to use a trademark. And obviously, you know, that's questionable. It's being questioned. Other people argue that the core, the object and purpose, if you want to get legal about it, of TRIPS is to prevent infringement. And no one's claiming that Australia is putting out fake packages of Marlboro. They're just banning the use. What they do is, and this has been going on for some time, the Australian one requires that 85% of the package be covered in really scary pictures, that the rest of it be in a very drab color, and that you have to use a specified font, Lucida, if you're interested, if you want to switch over to Lucida for your emails, and not use the font used in the Philip Morris trademark. And the case against Australian WTO and the two arbitrations essentially are about that. All these will be litigated, and I personally think they will lose based on TRIPS itself. So what caused the attention is, in effect, the dog that didn't bark. Why is no one in a hurry to win their case? And that gets you into the possibility, and again, we're into the interpretation, that tobacco companies benefit from delay. Why? Because you only get hooked when you're a teenager, so if you can delay regulations 5 years and pick up 5 years' worth of teenagers, it's worth delaying. New Zealand, for example, the Prime Minister, in introducing similar plain packaging regulations, one of the standard recipes under the Framework Convention, said that they were going to sit on this and they weren't going to put them into effect until they see the outcome of the Australia case, which in normal, the WTO case is at least 2 years away, and that would be fast. And the investment cases also look like they'll take a long time. So that's where the cases are right now. There have been no useful decisions. There's a jurisdictional decision in the Uruguay case I mentioned saying that the public health clause, a very strong public health clause in the Uruguay-Switzerland bilateral treaty, did not apply to this. You can argue about that. This raises lots of issues about investor-state dispute settlement. And as Fred mentioned, this is then coming into the debates in Trans-Pacific Partnership and TTIP about ISDS. Just as an example, one of the possible reforms mentioned to prevent, quote, frivolous suits like this was to make the losing party, in this case the plaintiff, pay the legal fees. Well, as you can imagine, a tobacco company would sign the check today if they could get 5 years' worth more of teenagers. So the cases have become highly controversial in the context of bilateral investment treaties as well as in public health fields. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gary. And we didn't devote this panel as such to the tobacco cases. In terms of kind of immediate public health impact, with over 6 million people a year dying from cigarette smoking, and this becoming an increasingly prevalent problem, particularly targeted in developing countries, as we in the developed countries seem to have come to grips to a great extent with the risks that we would face by smoking. This set of cases has tremendous public health implications. The Eli Lilly case has potentially longer-term implications from the standpoint of, you know, just exactly how the international intellectual property system is working and how public interests are assessed. So they are two sides of a very interesting coin. But as kind of unexotic as these issues may be in terms of listening and parsing through them, they potentially have really very broad and serious implications that may affect us all. With that, I open the floor. We've got time for questions from the audience or comments and so forth. Could you say your name, please?
Yeah. My name is David Riesenberg. I'm a law clerk. I'm a former student of Professor Reichman's, actually. I just wanted to ask if, given Gary Horlick's comment that the frivolous claims, which are likely to lose, does that encourage any of you gentlemen at all about this situation, such that perhaps there's not such a concern that international dispute settlement by itself is a bad thing, because again, the judges are arbitrators who are appointed by the governments, and stupid arguments often are not persuasive.
On the tobacco cases in particular, there are several sets of concerns. The first, in the WTO system, I didn't want to get into all this detail because I'm making a short comment. So Ukraine filed. 3 to 4 months later, Honduras filed. Then Dominican Republic, then Cuba. The lawyers understood perfectly well doing this that the WTO aims to get the same panel for all similar cases. So if the goal is delay, they just delayed just by staging the number when countries filed. So, as I say, this goes beyond whether they'll eventually win or lose. I think most people think, well, put another way, people cannot imagine the WTO, particularly the appellate body, you know, agreeing to this case. The concern is much stronger for investor-state dispute settlement. I don't know how deeply you or anyone else is into it. Argentina, the last time it crashed, not the first time I mentioned, nor the final one, did some screwing around with currency to put the cost as much as possible on foreigners, also not the first time, nor the last. And the result was over, depending on how you count them, well over 30 investor state cases, which is an interesting laboratory because you have essentially the same facts. It was the same twist of currencies involved in a variety of circumstances. And the panels, and that was in 2002, so you're now getting panel decisions. It's 10 years later, which is a point worth mentioning, that completely contradict each other on legal grounds. So you have two panels with completely different rulings, 180-degree opposite rulings on necessity, panels with completely different 180-degree rulings on umbrella clauses on the same all four points basically matter. So this has raised all kinds of questions, having nothing to do for the moment with public health, about whether investor-state dispute settlement is a viable project. Just to give you the counter-argument, I don't want to delay this. You can make a case for investor-state dispute settlement in situations where the courts of country X are not reliable. And it's the twist in TPP, of course, is that's true of some countries but not others. So you can't – sovereign countries are not going to agree to be designated as having their courts unreliable. Mexico, in a sense, was willing to, because the Mexican government probably thought they were also. Don't quote me. And so you have a situation where investor-state dispute resolution fora, where originally the goal was do it fast, do it cheap, it's arbitration. The standard, what they had in mind, to take one of the early cases, was you expropriated my hotel. What was the hotel worth? So we'll take an international commercial arbitration model where there are plenty of people in the world who are used to valuing hotels. You value hotels for lots of reasons, contract disputes, tax disputes, whatever. So we'll take those people, move them here, and they'll value the hotel. Fast forward to now, you have investor state panelists deciding whether tobacco regulation's okay and taking a long time to do it. And essentially, since it's three arbitrators, each party chooses one, it's pretty random what the results might be. So are you going to let decisions as to public health be decided by what one arbitrator feels like, and knowing that another arbitrator might come out differently? So Australia could well be sued by everyone they have bits with.
Go ahead. They each have a brief response, but make them brief because I'm sure other people probably have questions.
To your question, I wouldn't be concerned about the WTO.
Microphone.
I'm concerned about the WTO. These are seasoned arbitrators, and we have a case. These are seasoned judges, and we have a case already in which the exclusive right to the trademark gave way to under Article 17 to the right of the geographical indication. So I don't see that. I see that as an important precedent. But I do agree with Gary Horlick, and I think Jamie Love made the point. First of all, we don't even know. If you're talking about classical arbitration, well, now you've got to prove pretty high standards. You saw the standards in NAFTA, and you saw the standards for customary international law. But as Jamie was pointing out, if the treaty itself creates a kangaroo court with kangaroo criteria, then I don't know. It could go a lot of ways.
The EU proposal, Article 12 is what they proposed in the investment thing, is to say that you can get a judgment if there's a breach of legitimate expectations of investors arising from a government's specific representations or investment-inducing measures. Now, it's not like you're replacing the regular system with this newfangled, great arbitration system that has all these great advantages. You're giving the investors, if they lose in the regular system, to have a second bite at the apple that no one else gets, to figure out what the legitimate expectations were as some investment-inducing measure, and then bring a multi-billion-dollar fine against a sovereign state for having done that, having lost at the national court level. Now, is that a problem? These arbitrations are not cheap. They're not like, it's not like you're showing up with a public defender one day and kind of resolving these things. They just billow out of control in terms of what the expenses are. So it's a way of intimidating public officials to do things that piss off people that are going to like bring these cases against them. And it's a way of, you've got plenty of foreign shopping to go along around that. You have people that can afford to litigate like this. And what's really different from our point of view is there was a lot of restraint in the government-to-government dispute resolution. Because in the government-to-government dispute resolution, everyone's got some exceptions in their backyard that they're trying to kind of nuance the case kind of broadly. When you give Viacom or Pfizer or Lilly the right to litigate these things, the filter is off. I mean, they just go for it. And a lot of these agreements are poorly drafted. They're done in secret. They come out. Stan McCoy, who was the chief negotiator for the United States on the TPP, a couple of weeks ago, this week, is a lobbyist for the MPAA. Gloria Espinel, the former IP czar in the United States, who was part of the interagency review process, is now the head of the BSA. We have former lobbyists for the recording industry now running as a top copyright officials in the United States and the European Union. And we have a bunch of copyright lobbyists being hired by the Copyright Office, too. So you got this revolving door thing in the trade negotiators department. And you get these agreements done in secret by lobbyists moving back and forth to the government. And then they have like non-government officials kind of resolving the thing in these sort of secret proceedings and finding them. Yeah, it is a concern. It will be a problem. It is a problem. And what is the reason for saying that we should have them anyway? Why don't you let the market sort this sort of thing out? If a company, if Lilly wants to invest in Canada, let Lilly figure out whether that's a good place for them to invest. If they screw it up, if some company wants to build a mine somewhere or build a thing, if they have concerns about being expropriated, force the government to pay for some insurance against it or something like that. I mean, what's wrong with the old free market and solving these investor things? This is like a complete bailout from people like us to bail out big corporations if their expectations are not met of investment-inducing measures. You know, no thank you.
Well, we'll take, unfortunately, just one more question, but go ahead.
Sure. So I want to thank the panel. I think this is an incredible question. Sorry. I'm Chandra, and I guess there's no mic here. What I hear is a theme in your remarks, which is the theme of accidental blowback against the United States or against the country that proposed and championed the investor state dispute resolution treaty in the first instance. So in Gary's remarks, you hear the story of a treaty that's designed to protect Australian investments in Hong Kong being used by a Hong Kong company against Australia. We hear Jamie's comments, the the existence of all these compulsory licensing schemes in the United States, which might be inconsistent with our claims about similar things happening elsewhere, potentially subject to a challenge under investor-state for diminishing the investment of a foreign company into the United States. And of course, we hear this in Jerry's comments as well. So if that if accidental blowback is the worry, why, the question is, why isn't the United States, why aren't the countries that are pushing these treaties more concerned about this very problem? We know that China, India, et cetera, they're getting patents all over the world, right? We're not the only ones, and they're also now huge exporters of capital. They're making investments everywhere, right? So eventually, they'll be the ones bringing these claims under these reciprocal treaties. So wouldn't that be, shouldn't that somehow cause nations around the world that are proposing this to be a little more cautious?
I have to limit my remarks a little since I'm the U.S. counsel in TTIP, but suffice it to say, this is getting a lot of attention in TPP and TTIP. It'll be interesting to see what the countries come up with. My personal view, carefully say, personal view, a key factoid is the U.S. has never lost an investor-state case. It's a famous case involving a Mr. Lowen, L-O-E-W-E-N, which still amazes the arbitral community that the U.S. won. And there's a lot of rumors about it, so you have to go on the on TDM, the blog, to look up Lowen. But if you do, you will be entertained and horrified. And the U.S. somehow has not taken a lesson from it. So realistically, until the U.S. loses one, it's more fearless than countries that have.
But I think part of it, you look at the countries, the initial round of the bets were areas where there were small countries that didn't really have much of a potential to bring very interesting suits against the United States. NAFTA's a move in that direction, but the TTIP and the EU thing, you know, are really beginning to kind of ramp things up. But a lot of the cases that have been filed just in the last couple of years. I mean, there's been, this is a growth area in terms of litigation under this thing. So I think that if people sort of say, oh, the U.S. can't lose because we've never lost, you'd be like the investor that says that the stock market always goes up. And that's like good advice for a while. It's not always good advice.
Well, when you say governments, shouldn't they be concerned about it? The question that needs to be begged is, what do you mean by governments? Who are they talking to? If they were talking to a wide variety of people, they would be very concerned about it, and that's your point. But if they're only talking to people who tell them, this is great for us.
Well, and I'll just wrap up with a final and I think probably obvious response to your question. You're talking about private claimants bringing the cases. They can only win. If they lose, they haven't really lost anything. And where does the payment come from? It comes from the taxpayer. So if Canada loses, it's the Canadian taxpayer pays. If the U.S. loses, it's the U.S. taxpayer pays. If Eli Lilly wins, it's Eli Lilly that gets the money. So it's a no-lose proposition. Well, this is an enormous, complex subject. I'm very delighted that so many of you were willing to sit through to the end of this. And Carter wants to have a 35 to 42nd meeting of the International IP Interest Group. So I'll turn it over to him. Thank you very much.
Thanks.